Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you is The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, the fantastic radio station. And
yes.
Michael G. Haskin, you like to call it. It is a fantastic radio station.
It is.
Peace and justice and fantastic. Hey, listen, you know, nice that you tune in to this station during the day because we love to have you listen to what we do. And we love the fact that you choose us. And this whole idea of choice, this whole concept of choice, is what we will examine today with you. Roberta and I have had the issue of free will has come to our attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a remarkable way.
For a number of reasons. There have been a few articles that have been written from the scientific standpoint because a lot of research is being done to figure out whether we do or do not have free will and choice, and to find out whether everything is predetermined, pre-established.
I mean, do you have a choice over your body? You know, do you have a choice over whether you breathe? You know, can you choose to breathe or choose not to breathe?
Well, even if you should choose not to breathe to the point where you faint, then the moment you faint, your body would resume breathing automatically.
So there's something else
really
making the choice.
Right.
But can you choose to eat?
You can choose to starve yourself, sure.
To death?
To death, yes.
So you can not eat if you want to.
And unfortunately, many people do.
I know, and Gandhi did in a statement.
But he didn't die.
But he made a statement,
mm-hmm.
I can, and people knew he could die mm-hmm. that way. Determinism is whether you're determined. Well, that's not just what determinism means. We do have choices over our body, choices to do things, not do things, eat things, be a certain way, wear jewelry coming out of our ears, right? Pins and needles and tattoos, choices.
Well, we feel like we have a lot of choices.
I think the advent of tattoos is a symbol of people saying, I have free will.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I
don't have free will to get rid of it when I want to get rid of it, but I have free will to get it when I want to get it.
Sure, I think getting a tattoo is often an act of rebellion, but we feel like we have a lot of choice when it comes to our physical whereabouts, physical choices, looks, but physiological, not so much. We cannot choose not to digest our food. I mean, to some extent, we can upset ourselves to the point of stopping our digestion for that day, but not forever.
Our new free will allows us to reshape our bodies, not just working out, but you could do implants and supplants and replants.
There is actually some...
You make yourself taller.
Tape out there, or some CD that you can buy that through self-hypnosis, supposedly, I mean, I don't know if it works or not, but you can alter the shape of your body.
Yeah, well, even that, which I think I'm not so sure about
right,
how that
but
one
I'm
works.
Just saying,
I do know. I do know there are people who break their legs and they have implants put in their legs to make themselves taller. A very popular
yes.
surgery in Japan.
Yes.
I think you're laid it for 6 months and you wind up getting 6 inches taller.
We like to have control over things.
You know? So we've learned this, but here's the question today. What do you have control over? What don't you have control over? What are the different components of control? Is there such a thing of control? And if there is control, is it all your fault whenever anything goes wrong? Those are our issues that we're going to try to cover with you today. You know, what do we learn about genetic? Well, first let's go with some of the beliefs about determination.
About
determinism.
Determinism.
Determinism,
okay.
You know. Determinism is everything is in as a philosophy. Now we're going to take the philosophical approach.
Right. I think we ought to say, Armand, that the question of free will is a very old one. It's an ancient one. It's something that's been on the mind of human beings since forever. We've always wondered whether what happens is predestined or whether we really do create it as we go along. And so much so that philosophy there's a big body of philosophy that's been written and put forth about fatalism, determinism, and the nature of free will and choice.
When you fall in love, is it free will? It doesn't feel like free will.
And often you'll hear a person say, it was meant to happen.
But I love him. But I love him, therefore, it's okay no matter what he does.
We were together in a previous lifetime, and there was no chance I could not meet again.
I remember one woman who, a man went over to her, and he said to her, I know you from another lifetime. This was his great pickup line.
Uh-huh.
And she said, yes, the future.
Good one.
Armando Mil here, Roberta Maria Anti. So what is fatalism? What is determinism? Determinism, philosophically, is everything and every event is a natural and integral part of the interconnected universe, prior and coexisting. Get that? We're all atoms. And like everything that happens is related to everything around you and everything that happened before you. That's what determinism is, meaning that...
Well, one way that I find helpful to help myself understand what determinism is if I visualize the universe as a cloth, and then every thread in the cloth is interwoven with every other thread, so that there's no way that you could move one thread and not affect the rest of the cloth. That's one way to understand determinism, where everything is connected to everything else, no matter what the distance between the two. It could be a million miles apart.
Like a spider web, you know? The
right.
Nice thing about a spider web, if somebody steps
exactly.
on a spider web on one end of it, it's felt on the other end of the spider's
exactly
hanging out
like
of the
that.
Other
so
side.
That even though it may look like I choose to go somewhere today, the choice I make to go somewhere is determined by everything else that has happened and is happening.
Makes sense.
Right. It's all connected.
Now, fatalism is a different approach to this belief.
Although
in whether or not we have
the
free
two
will.
are confused, determinism
but
and
fatalism,
but they're very different.
Fatalism is a natural, in the natural world, is that, no, fatalism is that the natural world causes events in human life, but is not itself influenced by human will and behavior. No matter what I do, the same thing is going to happen. Fatalism is, this is going to happen to me, no matter what I do. A fatalistic approach is really not, nobody really believes in this, but it's kind of like a straw dog. It's a kind of a concept they want to put up there to be able to test determinism against and free will against.
I think one way to help myself understand fatalism is if I think of some people, how they use astrology. They look at the stars when a person is born, and they say, well, because the stars are here and there, that means this person is going to have this kind of life. That's fatalism, meaning that everything is preset in a scheme that is immutable, unchangeable, and that we have no control over, even though we feel we do, but that's an illusion. In reality, we are like a puppet on a string, and everything we do is predetermined by the rest of it, I guess.
You know, but it's a funny thing. You know, if you look from a giant distance, if you look from a million miles away, and you look at one human and their functioning, they don't look very different than the other humans. And it does look like everything is... If we look at ants and we look at ant colonies, we don't see that each ant is distinct, and we decide that ant is doing just what it was meant to do, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Sure.
We don't see the difference.
Right. I think fatalism is very much like that, that we have no choice over anything, and that it's almost like the destiny, whatever happens to us, in a way, was already written in a book of the history of the world, and so we just happen to follow the script.
Well, now, this is very important. And why this is important, my friends, is because we want to show you that you have more choices. We want to show you that there are different ways that you could approach this, because part of what people see is they see their behaviors and they see the consequences of their behaviors, and then they blame themselves for some of the choices they made.
And then they live in guilt and shame, and that's not good. So we want to... Well, and in fact, I mean, Armand...
Unless they were determined to live in guilt and shame...
Well, then we have no control over it anyway.
And
we really had no control over it to begin with. But so what I was saying was the idea is that... I don't know. I lost my train
of thought. I'm sorry, Roberta.
That's okay.
Okay, but let's...
I'll pick it up later on.
Poor impulse control, that we've had certain things that we've learned affects our determinism. We wonder, just because my grandfather was Sicilian, does that mean I'm automatically going to get angry when somebody takes something of mine? Well, funny enough, you know, they look at the genetic coding and they say, well, you know, it's funny, but these people with this genetic makeup tend to react this way. Well, there are certain things they've been able to study about genetic coding. And there's not very much they could determine is predetermined by your genetic coding, except your physical characteristics. But your behaviors, there's only a few that they've said, this we could figure out. What are the few they've uncovered so far? I mean, this is a baby science. So
well,
we're going to learn so much more.
Because of the human genome decoding, because of all the research in genetics, the question of what's inheritable is a huge one, and researchers are doing a lot of work to try to figure out what, not in the physical, but in the behavioral and the emotional aspects of human life, what is it that can be inherited, and what is it that is always inevitably inherited, and, of course, the goal is, can we do away with the things that we don't like, for instance, criminal behavior. Well, we don't know that criminality is inheritable, but we do know that shyness is, for instance.
We found that there is certain of the D4DR... Is it the D4DR gene at work here again? The chromosome?
Oh, that one, yeah.
The old chromosomes, longer chromosomes and the shorter chromosomes.
Right. Well, there's shyness. There is the inability to control one's impulsivity. That can be genetically inherited.
I mean, that we've shown not only just from the specific genes, but the length of the gene chain. Remember
mm-hmm,
that?
Yeah.
You know, who's pulling my chain? There is, if your gene chain is longer than somebody else's gene chain, you're likely to have less impulse control.
But you know, genetics is a funny thing, Armand, because the deeper we go into it, the less answers we seem to be getting, or the less... certainties we seem
but
to be getting.
But more questions we're getting,
exactly.
Which is the part that intrigues me.
Right.
Could it be that the reason you have less impulse control is because you're somewhat programmed to have less impulse control? The reason that two sisters are sitting with each other and one of them is crying because somebody died in the movies and the other one is eating a sandwich may have to do with some genetic makeup. It may be that there's a sensitivity that you inherit. Maybe. And this means that you who are crying because somebody died in the movie are not just being a silly sop. You know, and you who are eating the sandwiches not being a hard and cold person. Just right. That you're different.
I also think that genes are like a deck of cards. And when we're conceived, it's almost like someone is shuffling the deck, and then they lay out the cards, some of them, not all of them, and whatever the cards are that are laid on the table, that's the genes we get. And I think, Armand, that some of the genetic sequences that we inherit may derive to us from someone who had a particular behavior or you know, a particular situation in life, which then is handed over to us,
mm-hmm.
At least in the form of a resonance with that person.
At least in form of maybe a predisposition.
Right, right.
Right? Okay, so now back to this whole idea
the
of free will.
The free will, yeah.
We're there because genetics is an important part of it, right?
Yeah, what does
environment
genetics
is another part of it, because if we're talking about determinism, your environment, you know, your desire to run, you know, may be affected by what altitude you're born at. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be stuff in your environment that's going to affect you one way or another.
Right.
It's going to determine things. Nurturance, you know, what is there for you as you're growing up is going to determine a great deal about your free will. Do you feel free to, I spoke to a woman from Korea the other day who talked about how she was cast out of her family, and the only way she could meet her grandmother was by sneaking outside of the house to meet her grandmother. Hmm. And this is how she grew up. She grew up as a person who was sneaking outside her house to meet her grandmother, in effect.
Mm.
You know?
Right.
And that had to do with the nurturance. It didn't have to do with her genetic coding. It had to do with the way she was brought up.
But also it has to do with the customs of
the culture
that we come out of. I think that the customs of a particular group of people eventually interact with the genetic structures of the people in such a way that the genetics are affected by the culture and the customs. So
what you think is free will in your choice?
Yeah, I think that many of us are greatly affected by the cultural do's and don'ts of our predecessors, wherever they may be living, you know, 100 years ago, because they grew up in an environment that had the power to change their genetic structure, and then they handed over to us what they got out of that. So then we find ourselves in a different environment, but we still have the genes of the people, you know, who had to survive that challenge. So then how do we reconcile all of this? It's a lot of factors that affect the choices that we make, and when we think we're making a choice out of free will, are we really? Or are we just being pulled in a lot of different directions, and we just try to do the best we can? You know?
The phrase, it's your choice. I know people who could, I'd say about one quarter of the population, I call the abstract sequential population. These are people who, when they think, they always have two choices in their mind. Whenever they think about anything, if they say, I think I'll go to the store, they say, I'm going to go to the grocery store, I'll go to the drugstore. And then if they say, I'll go to the grocery store, they have two choices. I think I'll go to the one downtown or the one uptown. And then if I go to the one uptown, I'm either going to go to this part or that part. There's always two choices.
There must be a neurological configuration.
Well, there is something, because it's like a tree, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like tree-like thinking.
Right.
These people are notoriously indecisive because there are so many choices. Then they go to therapists, and the therapists try to help them, and the therapists say, you must make a choice. But they're not built to make choices. They're built to have two choices all the time, and therapists don't understand that. And so the therapists are, in effect, driving them crazy, saying them, make the choice that I agree with.
Right.
You know,
make the good choice.
Make the good choice, you know. Mm. So what are you going to do? Which one are you going to choose?
Mm.
And they can't choose.
Yeah,
so there are people who are incapable of making choice, but there are not people. Almost everybody is capable of hearing and seeing all of their choices. And what we would like to do today is to open up your world of choices.
Mm-hmm. And one of the choices that you do make is you choose to tune into WBAI at 1 o'clock and listen to Armand. And that's a good choice. Please continue to make that choice.
By us, you could tune in at 12 o'clock tomorrow and tune in to hear Roberta.
Oh, that's right. Tomorrow, that's right. I'm going to be on with Creative Health Solutions again. I'm so excited. Thank you for reminding me. I'm going to be doing time. I'm going to do a show about the nature of time. Yes, do tune in. I'd love to have you guys.
But again, you know, what feels like choice, and you know, I think the remote control was an amazing invention. It was an amazing event.
Well, it put a lot of people in a state of anxiety. I mean,
just think of what you could do with that.
I know people remote. Who cannot stop themselves from continuously spinning the channels and not able to make a choice.
Spinning is from the old days, Roberta.
Well, what's the name?
I don't know. Flipping.
Switching? Flipping? Okay, right. Sorry. Flipping.
Spinning is when you
I'm
actually
from
turn,
Italy. What do you
turn
want?
The dial. You used to get on the knees and you used to turn the dial on that machine.
Well, okay. Flipping. What's the name?
Spinning. I don't know.
Spinning. One of
I just learned what that handshake is called when two people have it. You know the fist-to-fist handshake?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I describing it right? So, like, when you want to acknowledge somebody...
Like two neurons.
Right, yeah. Like two fists, yeah. You know, when you put your fist out there straight out and the other person puts
right.
their fist out and they greet your fist with your fist. I didn't know what that was called. Do you know what that's called?
No.
It's called a dap.
A dap?
Dap. Give me a dap. It's
where,
a dap.
Where from?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's but somebody very hip called it and said it's called a dap.
Great.
Somebody told me I get
new.
My new language every day. So.
Okay. Well, back to the free will and choice. DAP, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying here is that we seem to be faced with a paradox, people, because even though it feels like we choose continuously, and in fact some of us struggle with that, as Armand was just saying, when we look at the neurology of it, when we look at what the brain is actually doing moment by moment of every day, well, the question is, are we really making a choice, or are things happening according to some kind of a program that we are just a part of, but we really don't have any control over?
So it could be a genetic program, it could be an environmental program. Let me give you a great example. Rebound pain or rebound headaches is a great example of this. There are people who get migraine headaches and they take a drug for it of any kind. They'll take a triptan. They'll take a triptan, or they take ergotamine, or they'll take Demerol for this pain. And then it'll quell the pain for the moment, you know. Sometimes it aborts the pain. Sometimes it just quells it. And then if within 5 days or 6 days they get another pain just like it, they take the same drug. Now, you know how this works with the key and lock system of the brain, Roberta. Once that lock is put into that keyhole, especially if it's something like Demerol or something like that, the person then, in order for their brain to get Demerol, they get a migraine so that the brain will feed them Demerol. Now, where's the free will? The brain has learned that in order to get the drug, it must give you a migraine. The brain learns that it can make you be in pain so it could get the drug. And then we can move to all addictions.
Right. Addiction is a big one when it comes to the freedom to choose.
Is it
but,
free will?
But
yeah.
I think, Armand, that there's an overlapping of two issues here, because what you're describing is a cause and an effect situation. I'm going even beyond that, or maybe before that, and I'm saying even... You know, not so much as an effect of something that has already occurred, like what you described, which is, yeah, I don't think a person has a free will in that case, because the brain has learned to do something in order to get something. But I'm asking, the experience of free will, is it an illusion to begin with? And the paradox that we are confronting is that it's both yes and no. We do have free will, but we don't, in the sense that it depends on the perspective of the observer. If you look at it from a certain perspective, yes, you are making a choice and you are responsible for it. And that's the truth. But also, the truth is that if you look at it from a different perspective, you are a thread in the cloth, and therefore you are affected by the cloth. You're just one of the threads, and so the choices that you make are really made by the cloth. also. So then, are you responsible for the choice or not? So I think ultimately, at the end of the road, the question is, are we responsible for the choices that we make?
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about when it comes to the end of the road related to this, because we've learned things about the future as well that are predictable. We're going to get to that in a minute. Let's stick with addiction for a minute, Roberta. A person is somebody who is addicted to alcohol, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
They now say to themselves, I've lost my job, I've lost my family, here's the bottle of alcohol. We look at them and we say, exercise your free will and don't drink that drink and go through all of the pain, the sweats, the staying up at night, all of the stuff that's going to be you're going through until you detox. Go through all of that torment. We'll even give you support. We'll have people stand around you and go through it. Now, that's supposedly the free will here is to starve my body so that I could get rid of the addiction, right?
Right.
Now, once you get through it, and it comes back after you and it says, come on, come on, come on, have a drink with me again. You're having a stressful time. Use your supposed free will. Now, is this free will or is this something that is saying do it or you die?
Mm.
And is it free will when somebody says to you, do it or you die?
And I believe that here we're faced by another huge paradox, and that is that the brain is always choosing the survival option.
That's right.
Even when it looks like the brain is making the choice of self-destruction. And that's a paradox that's going to be difficult to explain. And yet, even when the brain chooses to drink that alcohol or smoke that cigarette, and so it looks like the brain is giving up, the brain is betraying us, the brain is doing the wrong thing, the brain is compelling us to do something that's going to kill us. Actually, the brain is still acting in the interest of survival. And that's something that I think has to come before any other consideration or assertion about this topic, is that we have to say that in us there is a will to live that overrides anything else.
And it may even go a step beyond that. There may be a part of your brain, my friends, that wants you to die so that your genetic group may survive. It may be leading you to death because it determined that it doesn't want you to have babies because your grouping, your offshoot of the genetic field is not going to service your population as well.
Hmm.
And that there may be people who are born to be miserable and to die early and not have children.
Well, we certainly do know there are people who cannot reproduce and that seem to have been labeled by nature as unfit for reproduction. And they, you know, don't live long lives. They have genetic defects and whatnot. But even there, the brain is acting in the best interest of survival.
So you can't really trust your brain's choices. It's got pretty primitive choices at times. But when we come back, we're going to have to take our break. When we come back, first we're going to play you something that comes from a long time ago about choices. And when we come back, we're going to talk about future. We're going to talk about some recent research that kind of will prove to you that all of this clairvoyance and the possibility of being able to predict the future is true. And we're going to show it to you. It's amazing. It's amazing. Stuff. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friend. Here we go.
Beautiful. Of the class of 99. Wear sunscreen.
A little advice.
If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it. The long-term benefits of sunscreen have been proved by scientists, whereas the rest of my advice has no basis more reliable than my own meandering experience. I will dispense this advice now. Enjoy the power and beauty of your youth. Oh, never mind. You will not understand the power and beauty of your youth until they've faded. But trust me, in 20 years, you'll look back at photos of yourself and recall in a way you can't grasp now how much possibility lay before you and how fabulous you really looked. You are not as fat as you imagine. Don't worry about the future. Or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubble gum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. Do one thing every day that scares you. Sing. Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's only with yourself. Remember compliments you receive. Forget the insults. If you succeed in doing this, tell me how. Keep your old love letters. Throw away your old bank statements. Stretch. Don't feel guilty if you don't know what you want to do with your life. The most interesting people I know didn't know at 22 what they wanted to do with their lives. Some of the most interesting 40-year-olds I know still don't. Get plenty of calcium. Be kind to your needs. You'll miss them when they're gone. Maybe you'll marry. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll have children. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll divorce at 40. Maybe you'll dance the funky chicken on your 75th wedding anniversary. Whatever you do, don't congratulate yourself too much, or berate yourself either. Your choices are half chance. So are everybody else's. Enjoy your body. Use it every way you can. Don't be afraid of it, or what other people think of it. It's the greatest instrument you'll ever own. Dance. Even if you have nowhere to do it but in your own living room. Read the directions, even if you don't follow them. Do not read beauty magazines. They will only make you feel ugly. Get to know your parents. You never know when they'll be gone for good. Be nice to your siblings. They're your best link to your past and the people most likely to stick with you in the future. Understand that friends come and go, but with a precious few, you should hold on. Work hard to bridge the gaps in geography and lifestyle, because the older you get, the more you need the people you knew when you were young. Live in New York City once, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in Northern California once, but leave before it makes you soft. Travel. Accept certain inalienable truths. Prices will rise. Politicians will philander. You too will get old. And when you do, you'll fantasize that when you were young, prices were reasonable, politicians were noble, and children respected their elders. Respect your elders. Don't expect anyone else to support you. Maybe you have a trust fund. Maybe you'll have a wealthy spouse. But you never know when either one might run out. Don't mess too much with your hair, or by the time you're 40, it will look 85. Be careful whose advice you buy, but be patient with those who supply it. Advice is a form of nostalgia. Dispensing it is a way of fishing the past from the disposal, wiping it off, painting over the ugly parts, and recycling it for more than it's worth. But trust me on the sunscreen.
That's from Buzz Lerman, by the way, my friends. And this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. Always like that. I had to bring that back from the past, Roberta.
Yes, that's touches quite a me. Treat. Yeah, I like
touches
it.
Touches me about choices. Let me tell you that we, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We are with you today. And then I will be with you tomorrow, Thursday. Roberta will be with you at 12 o'clock. I'll be with you at 1 o'clock. And then maybe we could shake hands tomorrow, you know, Roberta, between 12 and 1.
You know, across the city?
Smooch across the city, right? Mm-hmm. And then next week, for your own information, my friends, Tuesday will be a longer program on relationships. It'll be from 1 to 3 o'clock. It'll be during our fun drive. Wednesday will also be a longer program. Roberta Atti and I will be talking about men. men specifically. And during that time, a very exciting event is going to happen. We have been able to get the Brooklyn Academy of Music to do a screening of the film Home, and we're going to talk about how we could create an event out of that, and we'll be offering those tickets during the fund drive starting next week. So let's go back to this now, Roberta. We're talking about determinism, and we're talking about free will and how everybody beats themselves up because they don't go on that diet, because they don't stop drinking, because they don't stop doing the drugs, and they don't get rid of that man
or
that woman, right? Or those kids. You know what a woman said to me the other day?
What?
She said, I've got two babies. One's 1 year old and one's 2 year old. She said, I realized that I could get a lot of money by selling these babies.
To whom?
People will buy them.
Really?
Yeah, beautiful babies. She said, people who want children will buy my babies. And those people have a lot of money and they'll take care of my babies. And I'm struggling and I can't give my babies anything. She said, so I'll get money and then the babies will get money. She says, but I can't bring myself to do it. She's a single mother. She said, but I wish somebody had sold me when I was a kid. And I thought, this is a very interesting question.
Right.
Imagine if when you were a baby and you were born, somebody looked at you and said, I'll buy that baby. And somebody very wealthy who brought you up very well, who valued you because they didn't have children of their own, who nurtured you like they would never have nurtured anything because this is what they hoped for, who gave you the best of... Would you have liked to have been a bought baby? Not just an abortion, not just a an adopted baby, a bought baby. How would you have liked to have been a bought baby? Interesting concept, don't you think?
It sure is.
I mean, what if, you know, what if the Shah bought you? What if somebody really, you know, powerful with a lot of money?
Well, I think a lot of people wonder about that.
Yeah, I wonder what it would have been like if my
mother wasn't struggling. I think a lot of people
struggling.
Wonder about what it would have been like if they had had the perfect family.
Well, you see, that's the thing. One of the things that they say is an expression, segue, is that you can't choose your parents, you know? And it's kind of true, but kind of not true.
I don't buy that.
You think you do choose your parents?
And of course, with today's technology, I cannot say I can prove it. But I have a certainty in me that it's a mutual choice. I really do. And I could argue and debate and whatever, and I'm not going to do that. But I just have a certainty in my... abdomen, that's the case, Armand, that we choose exactly where we're born, to what family, which parents, which country, what time, you know, in the line of history.
You know, Roberta, that sounds so flaky.
I know,
but let me tell you, wait, it sounds so flaky and so far out that had you said that to me 2 weeks ago, I would have gone, oh.
That's Roberta,
right, but now... What if you were to say to me, I choose what will happen tomorrow. I choose what's going to appear at the door, right? And I would say, that there goes Flaky Roberta again, saying that she could determine what's happening. Let's talk about it.
And you know what I would say now? I would say, aha!
You sure would. You can.
You've
been saying it to
That's
me ever
right.
all day. She brings me this article and waves it in my face.
Many articles. First of all, there was an article that came out a few weeks ago that I saw, or it may have been older, that I think I mentioned from the University of Amsterdam, that showed that the brain reacts emotionally to being shown emotionally charged images before the image is shown. So if someone decides to show you a picture of something that, let's say, upsets you, your brain reacts before you actually see the picture. Okay.
Well, now, how would that be?
Well,
but how would it be? How would you see something before you see it?
Well, people have been...
You mean your eyes are closed?
No, your eyes are open. You're being shown images. And out of these images, some of them don't mean anything. They're like a glass of water. And some images may be something that evokes emotional response. response in the amygdala.
I always cry at the sight of water.
Okay. Well, so you're unusual, but for most people that's a neutral image. An emotionally intense image could be an image of war or a sexually explicit image, something that evokes the emotional brain. Okay. Now, what was found was, and this was done in the lab with people hooked up to measuring equipment with electrodes, etc., so this is not speculation. The brains of these people was reacting to the emotionally significant images a few fraction of a second before the image was shown, as if the brain had known that the image that was going to come up was going to evoke an emotion. And this was so even though the images were shown randomly, chosen by a computer. Nobody knew what image was going to come up. So now, having said that,
That already, you stop right there. Nobody, and I can tell you 80% of the people listening, say no matter what research that was, and if it was in Amsterdam, they were probably smoking dope while they were doing it. So there is probably, it is not, most people are listening to that and saying, it is impossible. That's just, you know, that's Amsterdam for you. That's, you know, the city of free drugs and free sex.
In fact, this research caused such a stir in the scientific community that it's being picked up and replicated everywhere to
University did a similar study. University of California recently under Dr. Benjamin Liebert did a similar study. A number of studies just the same way, doing very similar things, showing that we have a predictive brain.
Now, so the brain seems to be able, this is what it comes to, the brain seems to be able to live in a timeless place, so that the brain seems to respond to things that have happened in the past or that are happening in the present, but it is actually responding to the future as well. Therefore, we could say the brain is living in a timeless zone.
An example of that would be, let's say you wanted to buy a house, and you saw a beautiful house, and you said, I would like to buy that house. And then when you sat in that house that you finally bought, you said, this is exactly what I thought I would feel. Well, in a way, when you thought of buying that house, you kind of used your predictive brain to say, what would I feel like in there? Well, how could you have known what you were going to feel like in that house if you had never bought it before? Because there's an element of the brain that can predict.
I think we're talking about slightly different things, Armand, because what I'm saying is that actually there is there's an ability on the part of the brain to register and respond to events that have happened in the future. So it's not so much the choice of a house, which I can imagine myself in the house today, and then I end up in that house because I, you know, that's one aspect of it. But actually, we're saying there is a framework of reality that extends from the past into the future, and we happen to be in the middle, which is the present. And
give me an example of that.
Well, we used to think that the brain could only relate to the present where we are, or to the past, which we have in the form of memory.
Give me an example.
However, it turns out the brain is actually responding to the part that has not happened yet, as if it knew what was going to happen. Well, for example, in another study, the research shows that the brain is able to perceive things that are not physically present in our immediate environment and that have not yet happened, and that eventually do happen, and the brain has already responded to that event.
Give me an example of it, Roberta, instead of things like what? Like a bomb? Like an ice cream cone? Like what?
I'm not sure what you're asking me.
What's an example of a brain anticipating a physical thing that has not happened that does happen, according to the research? What were people anticipating, not just colors?
Well, I mean, I don't want to get morbid, but maybe people anticipate illnesses or anticipate health.
Maybe people anticipate death
or anticipate events that happen in the world. Maybe people anticipate what's going to happen to a loved one or to a pet or, you know. But what I'm saying is it's not so much to being connected to someone because we love them and having a premonition because they're getting sick or something. I'm saying, in general, the brain is connected to the future, and if we know that, which the research is now allowing us to know that, I wonder, once we start to explore that possibility and work with it, what are we going to find out about ourselves and the world we live in that normally we don't believe we have access to?
It may be difficult for you to gather the significance of this piece of research, which is this the mind in the box?
The ghost in the machine?
Yeah,
mind in the box, I like that.
The ghost in the machine. The idea here is that you have a mind that has a way of seeing the future. And even though you may think that's a difficult thing, or you could say, well, yeah, if I get sick, maybe I know that I'm going to die. If I could sense this, I sense that. It's been validated. And what we're validating here is that you have a predictive mind. Now I'm going to give an example of this. Maybe on a pathological level, a person goes and goes out on a date and then meets somebody who he takes home. And this person who he takes home robs him after he falls asleep. And he's robbed and everything of his, every possession of his is valuable, is taken. And he says, that's what happens when I go to a bar to meet somebody. But this next person I meet in the park. So I say to myself, I'm not going to get robbed this time. And he meets this person in the park and takes that person home. And sure enough, that person robs him of all of his belongings. So he said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go to the church. And he goes to the church to meet somebody. And he meets somebody at the church, and sure enough, that person robs him of everything he's got. And so he asks the question, how could I have gotten robbed by everybody? Why am I so exploited? We may know that there is a part of the brain that is choosing people to hurt you, selecting their potential beyond your consciousness, who will do things to you because it has a program of sorts for you. And going back to what Roberta said, this program, it believes, is either for your immediate survival or survival of the species. And so this very idea that people put themselves in danger when they could use all the logic in the world to prove that they're not in danger, or make the wrong choices or the wrong relationships over and over again, and they have repeated patterns that seem invisible, means that maybe there is a part of you that does predict what is going to happen because, in effect, it wants it to happen.
Mm. And now the question would be, why would the brain want me
to get
hurt? And of course, that's the question that Armand and I were asking ourselves once we were exploring this path. And this is what we came up with. Well, as long as we're able not to take things too personally, and then if we end up victimized over and over again in situations like what Armand described, we don't get stuck in the victim role and start to believe that kind of thing about ourselves. Perhaps the brain is symbolically trying to communicate something that if we get it, if we get what the meaning is, it's not about hurting us. It may be about something completely different if we get the symbolic meaning of it. It may be something about, I don't know, making up for something that happened in our family system. It may be something that we need to learn about ourselves that we can only learn in that particular way.
It may be that it wants you to be free of all possessions so that you could discover yourself. You know?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, I remember once around Christmas, I walked into a store, and I went in and I bought a lot of things at Christmas. And when I walked out, I said, gee, I said to the owner of the store, I feel much lighter now because all that money was weighing down my wallet,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I had paid so much money for the things I bought. Maybe in some way the brain wants you to go this way so that you can move in another direction, like free of materialism, to find a different way of staying alive and being and evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the brain is saying to you, no, I want you to die. And maybe that is what the brain wants you to do.
I want you to die because I want you to live.
I want you to die because I want us to live. What do you mean by I want you to live? I want you to die because I want you to live.
Well, there, you know, we are splintered in a way, meaning that maybe there's a part of us that the brain has determined, okay, this part of you, Cookie, it has got to go.
Right. And give up on relationships, would you please?
And maybe relationships are not for you right now. And so, okay, this is the only way I have to show you that there's a different direction that you need to take in order to find yourself. So maybe it's a part of us that needs to die in order for the whole of us to be able to live. That could be.
And on the more macabre side.
Well, I didn't want to go there.
You know, I know you don't want to go there, but I think if we're going to try to accept all that is available to us, accept everything, including death, accept it all, see it all, because your brain could be wrong. See, the whole idea that the brain has a predictive methodology and possibility doesn't mean the brain is right. The brain will tell you to eat that donut, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're telling your brain not to eat, sometimes your brain will say, no, we've got to eat.
But it may be a symbolic message.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I'm trying to say, that when things look that negative, when the brain consistently keeps trying to, it seems like the brain keeps trying to trip us up.
You don't want people to feel bad.
No, I really don't believe the brain ever wants to destroy us.
I think it does.
Yeah.
For the sake of the species.
Of the species, right.
Sometimes. And so what? So say you want to
destroy
me.
I'm not upset about that.
And it doesn't mean I'm going to be destroyed. It means you're just another person who's got an idea about me, you know, and it may be myself. But I'm not going to blame myself for having that. I'm just not going to listen to my own biological imperatives or my old genetic encoding or what I hear in the environment. But the idea here is gather all the information. Get as close to your friends as you can. Get as close to your enemies as you can. Learn everything.
And visit the future.
Visit the future.
Often. Look at the future. What's in there for you? What
does your mind tell you?
Yeah. And even what would you like for the future? I mean, that's something worth exploring. What would you not like for the future? I think, you know, when it comes down to it, Armand, I think that because we're made of components that are so tiny that they are so small that they have in fact no mass, you know, when you look at what we're made of, the smallest components of the stuff that we are made of, we're really made of energy. Energy is not bound by time and space. So as energy beings, we're not limited to perceptions in the past and the present. As energy beings, we have access to everything and everywhere. I think we tend to forget that we are energy beings because sometimes we feel so earthbound by the body that we inhabit. What's the word I'm looking for? But this is an interesting thing, Armand, that we're talking about.
Sure is, my friends, and thank you for listening with us today. Thank you, Roberta Atti.
Thank you.
Be sure to tune in tomorrow at 12 o'clock, my friends, to hear Roberta on WBAI at 99.5 FM, and at 1 o'clock, back to us. She'll ping-pong them backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to listen to today's program, you could do it on WBAI.org, or you could do it through thepositivemind.org. Back with you tomorrow, my friends.